Chapter 164. Queen Pomeree, it is well to learn something about people before being introduced to them, and so we will here give some account of Pomeree and her family. Every reader of Cook's Voyages must remember To, who, in that navigator's time, was king of the larger peninsula of Tahiti. Subsequently, assisted by the muskets of the Bounty's men, he extended his rule over the entire island. This Otto, before his death, had his name changed into Pomeree, which has ever since been the royal patronymic. He was succeeded by his son, Pomeree II, the most famous prince in the annals of Tahiti. Though a sad debauchee and drunkard, and even charged with unnatural crimes, he was a great friend of the missionaries, and one of their very first proselytes. During the religious wars into which he was hurried by his zeal for the new faith, he was defeated and expelled from the island. After a short exile he returned from Imio, with an army of 800 warriors, and in the Battle of Narii routed the rebellious pagans with great slaughter, and re-established himself upon the throne. Thus, by force of arms, was Christianity finally triumphant in Tahiti. Pomeree II, dying in 1821, was succeeded by his infant son, under the title of Pomeree III. This young prince survived his father but 6 years, and the government then descended to his elder sister, Amata, the present queen, who is commonly called Pomeree Vahinei, or the first female Pomeree. Her Majesty must be now upwards of 30 years of age. She has been twice married. Her first husband, and was a son of the old king of Taher, an island about 100 miles from Tahiti. This proving an unhappy alliance, the pair were soon afterwards divorced. The present husband of the queen is a chief of Imio. The reputation of Pomeree is not what it ought to be. She, and also her mother, were, for a long time, excommunicated members of the church, and the former, I believe, still is. Among other things, her conjugal fidelity is far from being unquestioned. Indeed, it was upon this ground, chiefly, that she was excluded from the communion of the church. Previous to her misfortunes, she spent the greater portion of her time sailing about from one island to another, attended by a licentious court, and wherever she went all manner of games and festivities celebrated her arrival. She was always given to display. For several years the maintenance of a regiment of household troops drew largely upon the royal exchequer. They were trouserless fellows, in a uniform of calico shirts and pasteboard hats, armed with muskets of all shapes and calibers, and commanded by a great noisy chief, strutting it in a coat of fiery red. These heroes escorted their mistress whenever she went abroad. Some time ago, the queen received from her English sister, Victoria, a very showy, though uneasy, headdress, a crown, probably made to order at some tinman's in London. Having no idea of reserving so pretty a bauble for coronation days, which come so seldom, Her Majesty sported it whenever she appeared in public, and, to show her familiarity with European customs, politely touched it to all foreigners of distinction, whaling captains, and the like whom she happened to meet in her evening walk on the Broom Road. The arrival and departure of royalty were always announced at the palace by the court artilleryman, a fat old gentleman who, in a prodigious hurry and perspiration, discharged minute fowling pieces as fast as he could load, and fire the same. The Tahitian princess leads her husband a hard life. Poor fellow! He not only caught a queen, but a Tartar, when he married her. The style by which he is addressed is rather significant. Pomeree Tani, Pomeree's man, all things considered, as appropriate a title for a king consort as could be hit upon. If ever there were a henpecked husband, that man is the prince. One day, his carisposa giving audience to a deputation from the captains of the vessels lying in Papeete, he ventured to make a suggestion which was very displeasing to her. She turned round, and, boxing his ears, told him to go over to his beggarly island of Imio, if he wanted to give himself airs. Cuffed and contumed, Poor Tainy flies to the bottle, or rather to the calabash, for solace. Like his wife and mistress, he drinks more than he ought. 6 or 7 years ago, when an American man of war was lying at Papeete, the town was thrown into the greatest commotion by a conjugal assault and battery made upon the sacred person of Pomeroy by her intoxicated Tainy. Captain Bob once told me the story. And by way of throwing more spirit into the description, as well as to make up for his oral deficiencies, the old man went through the accompanying action, myself being proxy for the Queen of Tahiti. It seems that, on a Sunday morning, being dismissed contemptuously from the royal presence, Tainy was accosted by certain good fellows, friends and boon companions, who condoled with him on his misfortunes, railed against the Queen, and finally dragged him away to an illicit vendor of spirits, in whose house the party got gloriously mellow. In this state, Pomeroy Vahiny won. Was the topic upon which all dilated vixen of a queen probably suggested one. It's infamous, said another, and I'd have satisfaction, cried a third. And so I will. Tainy must have echoed, for off he went, and ascertaining that his royal half was out riding, he mounted his horse and galloped after her. Near the outskirts of the town, a cavalcade of women came cantering toward him, in the center of which was the object of his fury. Smiting his beast right and left, he dashed in among them, completely overturning one of the party, leaving her on the field, and dispersing everybody else except Pomeroy. Backing her horse dexterously, the incensed queen heaped upon him every scandalous epithet she could think of. Until at last the enraged Tainy leaped out of his saddle, caught Pomeroy by her dress, and dragging her to the earth, struck her repeatedly in the face, holding on meanwhile by the hair of her head. He was proceeding to strangle her on the spot, when the cries of the frightened attendants brought a crowd of natives to the rescue, who bore the nearly insensible queen away. But his frantic rage was not yet sated. He ran to the palace, and before it could be prevented, demolished a valuable supply of crockery, a recent present from abroad. In the act of perpetrating some other atrocity, he was seized from behind, and carried off with rolling eyes and foaming at the mouth. This is a fair example of a Tahitian in a passion. Though the mildest of mortals in general, and hard to be roused, when once fairly up, he is possessed with 1,000 devils. The day following, Tainy was privately paddled over to Imeo in a canoe, where, after remaining in banishment for a couple of weeks, he was allowed to return, and once more given his domestic adhesion. Though Pomeroy Vahiny won, be something of a Jezebel in private life, in her public rule she is said to have been quite lenient and forbearing. This was her true policy. For an hereditary hostility to her family had always lurked in the hearts of many powerful chiefs, the descendants of the old kings of Teerbu, dethroned by her grandfather Otu. Chief among these, and in fact the leader of his party, was Pufai, a bold, able man, who made no secret of his enmity to the missionaries, and the government which they controlled. But while events were occurring calculated to favor the hopes of the disaffected and turbulent, the arrival of the French gave a most unexpected turn to affairs. During my sojourn in Tahiti, a report was rife which I knew to originate with what is generally called the missionary party that Pufai and some other chiefs of note had actually agreed, for a stipulated bribe, to acquiesce in the appropriation of their country. But subsequent events have rebutted the calumny. Several of these very men have recently died in battle against the French. Under the sovereignty of the Pomeroys, the great chiefs of Tahiti were something like the barons of King John, holding feudal sway over their patrimonial valleys, and on account of their descent, warmly beloved by the people, they frequently cut off the royal revenues, by refusing to pay the customary tribute due from them as vassals. The truth is, that with the ascendancy of the missionaries, the regal office in Tahiti lost much of its dignity and influence. In the days of paganism, it was supported by all the power of a numerous priesthood, and was solemnly connected with the entire superstitious idolatry of the land. The monarch claimed to be a sort of Baibo of Tereroa, the Saturn of the Polynesian mythology, and cousin german to inferior deities. His person was thrice holy. If he entered an ordinary dwelling, never mind for how short a time, it was demolished when he left, no common mortal being thought worthy to inhabit it afterward. "I'm a greater man than King George," said the incorrigible young Otu to the first missionaries. "He rides on a horse, and I on a man." Such was the case. He traveled post through his dominions on the shoulders of his subjects, and relays of mortal beings were provided in all the valleys. But alas, how times have changed, how transient human greatness. Some years since, Pomeri Vahinei, the granddaughter of the proud Otu, went into the laundry business, publicly soliciting, by her agents, the washing of the linen belonging to the officers of ships touching in her harbors. It is a significant fact, and one worthy of record, that while the influence of the English missionaries at Tahiti has tended to so great a diminution of the regal dignity there, that of the American missionaries at the Sandwich Islands has been purposely exerted to bring about a contrary result. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.